Hey everybody, this is Sejin, host of the Say Report. I'm here with my host companion Devin Decker. Before we get going today,
I'm Devin Decker. How you doing, everybody?
Hey, you'll note this week that we are putting up one of our famous look back episodes, where we're going to be looking back at the phenomenal career of Mike Judge, focusing mostly on Beavis and Butthead Do America, which is in its 25th anniversary this year. But we're also gonna, we're gonna dive into some other stuff. The reason we're doing this is because I'm not here right now.
Future messages about the past to the future.
I'm in Texas. I am out. I'm at a wedding. My dearly beloved cousin Sasha is marrying her love Sean, and I'm there watching it right now. Actually, it probably happened a couple of days ago, and I hope that the brunch was okay. I'm bringing a quiche. I hope it didn't upset anybody's stomach. But I just wanted to give a quick shout out to them and say, hey, congrats. Love you guys. We put this together, and it kind of just all worked out that I was going to be in Texas at the same time. And I get to talk a bunch now about King of the Hill. So love you guys. Love King of the Hill. And I'll see you guys there.
Yes. I love to you and to everyone. May your love be a roller coaster. Because, that's a big part of this one. I'm just excited because the title of this episode is The Devin and Sejin Do Beavis and Butthead Do America Report.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Enjoy, guys.
Yeah, now let me end this with a Hank Hill quote about how this all kind of worked out for us. You know what I say? If you plan ahead, then when things happen, you're prepared. In the year 1996... a cinema classic was born, based on the TV show of the same name. Beavis and Butthead take to the cinema screen. And now, 2021, Beavis and Butthead 2 have decided to talk about it. Oh, man, everybody. Hey, we're on a time capsule episode, so we may be talking to you out of time and space. But that's okay, because this movie kind of exists out of time and space. Like, it's weird. For a movie that is so ingrained in 90s culture, I feel like it's one of those things that people 30 years from now are still going to be, like, looking back on and watching. And, it's weird. I don't want to call it, I don't want to call it a true time capsule of a movie. I don't want to call it, like a historical film by any stretch of the imagination. They literally didn't know whether to plan for Bill Clinton winning or losing the election in this film, which is why he's in so little of it, because otherwise I think Judge would have gone even harder into some Clinton stuff. But yeah, we're on the 25th anniversary of Beavis and Butthead Do America, a movie that, mind you, when it came out in 1996, broke the record for a December film opening, only to be broken the next year by Scream 2 and eventually Titanic. But still, at the time, Beavis and Butthead Do America, the only animated MTV film to date, ladies and gents, and here we go. Dev, what you think?
Well, first of all, pausing for station identification, welcome to the Say Report. He's Sejin Sarawick. I'm Devin Decker. I don't even want to begin to parse which one of us is Beavis and which one of us is Butthead in the whole Beavis and Butthead 2 of it all. And also, just to kick off another important reason why we're doing this, you know that a sequel's coming on Paramount Plus? That it finally got greenlit?
So it got it hit hard, right? Like, yeah. It was a huge success, and it was very, very early in the MTV Films oeuvre, right? Like when they first started making their own thing. And there's a ton of that going on, right? So they want Mike Judge to just keep going with his baby, but he openly admitted even before making this film that he was done with Beavis and Butthead. It had been 6 seasons, I think, on TV at that point,
yeah.
And he was contracted for 8 or 9, and he's like, look, I just want out. And they're like, well, you gotta make a movie for us now. And so he actually was all right, here's the deal. I'm going to make this movie and then I'm getting the fuck away from these characters.
And they're like,
because right. Like everybody in this movie, all he wanted to do was get the hell away from Beavis and Butthead.
I mean, to go just facts on that, it was an 8 season contract that he had with them, and he parsed it out so that this film would satisfy a season's worth of content. Yeah, which is
so he does one more season after the movie, right? Yeah. And then that's it, Beavis and Butthead in the 90s.
And then that weird reboot that I still haven't been able to bring myself to watch.
It's fine. It's weird. It's just season 8 of Beavis and Butthead. The best part about it is that the music and the references that they can kind of make in it are just, you know, 15 years later. It's real wild. It's around the same time that they also tried to bring back Celebrity Deathmatch for a season. You remember that?
I do remember that. That one did not go over as well.
No, because we've moved on from watching Snoop Dogg beat the shit out of Biggie, and now we know why. But yeah, man, Beavis and Butthead is a weird cultural touchstone that merited itself a whole goddamn film. It happened, and it was a huge hit. And then, like, 25 years later, like, Mike Judge stands atop a mountain of success at this point. Like he's never stopped since this show.
Yeah, an empire. I would say that Mike Judge built himself an empire.
A nice little quaint empire. He doesn't do much that like breaks out in any uncomfortable way. But yeah, empire is a good word for it.
Yeah. He's like Switzerland though. He's neutral. He's not really weighing in on anything outside of the empire.
Well, it's weird because as a guy that he kind of takes it upon himself to speak for neutrality, if that makes any more sense. You know what I mean?
I do. Like, yeah, that's actually a wonderful way to put it.
Yeah. He's a very vocal, neutral voice in as far as like politics and cultural politics go.
Yeah. So we're talking about this as a cultural touchstone, but it's a time capsule episode. So I would be remiss if I didn't sprinkle into this one some of my own personal autobiographical connection to Beavis and Butthead to America.
Yeah. No,
and I'm going to start with, this was the very first film that my parents forbid me to go see. I was so excited to see Beavis and Butthead to America. And the real, like, crazy part about that is that I was never someone who watched Beavis and Butthead. Like, I didn't really watch MTV, probably because my parents were like, you're not allowed to watch MTV at some point. And then, like, it just flew past me. I say that, but I remember watching The Head when I was far too young to appreciate what The Head was about. Yeah. But I saw the trailers for Beavis and Butthead to America, and I guess in my, like, weird little 10-year-old Devin brain, I'm like, well, that legitimizes it, right? You people love movies in this house, and if Beavis and Butthead are getting a movie, they're finally worth, like, a watch. They're finally worth our time in some way. And I was specifically told, you cannot see that movie. Which, at the time, I assumed it must be because it was rated R. And that was also strange because I had been watching R-rated movies in the theaters since I was 5 years old. So I didn't understand what was so negative about the whole Beavis and Butthead of it all. But then today, come to find out, it's rated fucking PG-13.
And like, to the point where they like took scenes out in order to keep it PG-13. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like they, yeah.
And there's a naked bust on the front of a ship. There's a maidenhead or a masthead of a naked mermaid that has like full on nipples and areola. And I'm like, the 90s, man, were a weird fucking time.
To that point, I will say we are not talking about like the 80s girls could be in bras and you can see one nip and it's still a PG movie. No, we're in PG-13 territory and this exists now. And I will say to that I think the reason that they get away with that is an actual piece of art on display in Las Vegas that they are then drawing. So it'd be like drawing the Statue of Liberty and like if they had
and not given her
reason,
nipples,
that would be weird, right? That it would be like so there is an art rule, right? Like there is like a weird, like there is a weird line that they have to draw where, like, you know, if Jimmy Neutron walks by the Statue of David and for some fucking reason like he's got a t-shirt and shorts on, we'd all question that. Well, maybe not Jimmy Neutron, but to my point, the idea being that like they get away with that because that is a particular piece of actual art that can be referenced, versus much later in the movie when like we see things like women starting to get undressed. I'm thinking specifically of the Rat Fink scene and like the white zombie music playing, and like we see women start to get undressed, and then like before things get too much they warp into something else, right? Like there's always a constant like shift in scene before things get too dangerous everywhere else.
Yeah, but it really was one of those moments where I'm like, this movie can't be rated R. As I start the movie up, to watch it, I'm like, this can't be a movie that's rated R. So I don't really understand why it was such a line in the sand for my parents. And the fact of the matter is Beavis and Butthead were incendiary television. Even more so than Bart Simpson being disrespectful to authority and celebrating being a slacker. Direct quotes.
Thrown into the same bucket though, as The Simpsons, I would argue, in a lot of households. But sorry, keep
going. No. Well, it's thrown into the same bucket until Beavis and Butthead actually have people starting fires. Beavis and Butthead... I played the 1994 Super Nintendo game today to just try to touch some more moments in it. And that opens with, these are cartoon characters. Do not try to emulate what they do. You'd have to be incredibly stupid to even want to.
Yeah.
And that came out in 1994. So, and that is after the fact that that kid burnt his house down because of Beavis's love of fire.
Well, and that becomes the thing that we didn't talk about in the 90s that we do talk about now, that when a tragedy like that occurs, because that is a tragedy, you know, like when something like that occurs, now we are smart enough as a culture to start asking other questions like, well, what else is going on? Like, yes, this is an influence, and yes, we should maybe look at that, but we can't focus on just that because we know that 20 million other kids were watching Beavis and Butthead and didn't burn their houses down. So something is different here, right? And it's interesting that you bring this conversation up so nice and early for me, Dev, because this is, I think, kind of the meat and potatoes of what this episode's probably going to be. And honestly, of a lot of Mike Judge's career going forward is, like, I think Mike Judge is one of those artists that because he exists in the neutrality, right, of it all, that, like, we don't necessarily jump right to him but I think you could put him up there as on the same level as somebody like a Kevin Smith, where we really kind of have to remember what they're trying to get across when they put characters like this in front of us. And so the idea being, when Mike Judge creates Beavis and Butthead, is it a celebration of Beavis and Butthead, or are we supposed to not want to be like them, much like a la Kevin Smith just a couple of years earlier in Clerks? Like, when we look at Dante and Randall, are these guys to emulate or are these guys to despise? And we talked about the idea when we did our Clerks episode that obviously you're supposed to despise them. Obviously you're not supposed to want to be these guys. That didn't change the next 20 years of filmmakers thinking that they were the fucking heroes of that movie, and Smith is, you know, is still kind of dealing with the repercussions of that, of like how do I make another movie that makes enough money to keep making movies while at the same time trying to explain to people that that wasn't the point, is like something he still struggles with as an artist, right? And Judge, I think, really kind of finds himself in that same conversation with his audience, and it is why he is so eager to get the fuck away from these two at the time that this movie gets made. Is like, I think he's realized at that point that, like, his monster has gotten bigger than him, and too many people are misinterpreting it. And it is now that I really kind of want to point to kind of the hero of my own personal story in all of this, and that is the 3-star review written by one Roger Ebert himself in December of 1996 when this movie comes out. He ends up thoroughly enjoying this film. Roger Ebert and Roper. No, not Roper.
Siskel. It was Gene Siskel,
right?
At the time.
Yeah, so Siskel,
they gave it two thumbs up.
Thumbs up, right. And Ebert goes further to give it a 3 out of 4 stars. And, like, yes, his review is riddled with, like, questioning himself while watching the film and wondering why he's enjoying himself. And you can point to that kind of that questionability within it for sure. But there is one very specific line in it that I just really love, that where he... Sorry, I'm, like, literally pulling it up.
No, that's fine. He
says right at the end of his second paragraph, those who deplore Beavis and Butthead are confusing the messengers with the message. So there are people out there that he knows are going to just write the movie off and are going to write the entire cultural movement of Beavis and Butthead off because they hate these characters, much like your parents just being like, you can't watch this because, like, we don't want you going out there burning the house down. Like that entire attitude of saying, like, no, these characters cannot be put out into the world because they're just too dangerous. That idea being that people out there are going to look at these characters and want to be like them is present. And he immediately says, like, he's like, anybody who looks at this and thinks that immediately, like, you're missing the point. Like, the movie wants you to agree with that. Like, this movie is your friend. This entire concept is your friend. These are not characters to emulate in any way.
Right.
And so Beavis and Butthead in my own history is it's really weird because like 2 or 3 years later in my life, I probably would have been in that same boat with you where like my parents were like forbidding me from seeing this, but I was just a little too early. So like Beavis and Butthead was one of those things that I was aware of. And like, it was in the oeuvre at the time when this movie came out. If you had asked me how long Beavis and Butthead had been around, I would have just said forever. Like my concept of the world at that point was just like, they've always been around. They are part of TV because they were being made fun of everywhere. On top of that, we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that Judge was also working on SNL at this time doing TV Funhouse shorts with like Milton and the Stapler, right? Which mm-hmm. eventually leads to Office Space.
Yeah.
Right. So like Judge was already working and everywhere. MTV was also a cultural touchstone at this point. Like to ignore the impact of MTV at this point in the 90s would have been ridiculous. Like, and so there's so much about that I think my parents like it didn't even occur to them to tell me to not pay attention to Beavis and Butthead just because like how do you stop your kid from going outside? You know?
Right.
So when Beavis and Butthead Do America come out, like my parents didn't stop me from seeing it. Also, as you mentioned, it's PG-13. So at some point when it ends up on video, like a couple of years later, and people are like renting it to watch at sleepovers and stuff, it's not on the banned list. Like the stuff that is on the banned list is like Terminator and shit, which is funny enough the stuff I ended up watching anyway, but like it wasn't. So Beavis and Butthead becomes this thing that goes on earlier in the night, like when we're doing like the sleepover and we're all like fucking playing like Manhunt and shit. Beavis and Butthead is the movie that's on while we're all kind of getting there and we all eat dinner and then we all go out, and then later on in the night is when we start to watch fucking like the darker shit, like literally like Darkman and stuff like that, right? Like so It is weirdly innocuous in my history, and I know that Beavis and Butthead had that kind of impact on people because like I remember when South Park became the next thing, right? Like mm-hmm. it seems like that was the shift from Beavis and Butthead. It was then South Park was the thing that was banned,
which
and
that's is the thing not I surprising at all. Watching right. this movie, yeah. there is yeah. so much South Park in the DNA of Beavis and Butthead. It's fascinating.
So,
but
like,
continue,
I understand where you're coming... No, just to put a cap on it, like, I understand where you're coming from with the idea of, like, Beavis and Butthead being the no-no thing that came from your parents, that being the first thing. For me, I think it was just early enough in, like, the world that, like, it didn't even occur to my parents to stop me. So, like, shame on them, I guess. I don't know.
No, but, like, I'm...
But Beavis and Butthead Do America, like, as a thing, has just kind of always been there for me. And that's fucking wild. Like, to really think about.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense. And also, just to add, you know, a weird connection to this film, truly, the second film that I was forbidden to see from my parents was Striptease, starring one Demi Moore. And the reason why is because I see Demi Moore, and growing up in this house, like, where A Few Good Men was literally watched every weekend that first year we lived out in Templeton, because we didn't have cable, so it was movies all the time until, you know, the black box era of the Decker household started. Like, I knew Demi Moore from that, and I was more excited to see her in another movie. Not even thinking about, like, oh, it's like she's a stripper. Like, no, she's Demi Moore. She's a great actor, and I'm excited to see that. And they're like, no, you need to understand that sometimes content is a thing, and you probably can't see that movie until you're of age.
Yeah, and to that point, I think like American Pie maybe might be the first thing. I'd have to think back a little bit further and see. My parents were very much like, you can't see an R-rated film. That's a no-no. Didn't stop me. But like,
yeah,
that
course.
Was the thing that where they were like, that's what you can't do. But I'm trying to think of like a specific movie that they put the kibosh on, and it probably had to be like American Pie. When did Bigger Longer Uncut come out?
So Bigger Longer Uncut is also 1999. Okay. It seems like that'd be your year.
Yeah, that's kind of the year where my parents really kind of start putting like the handle on, like, maybe we need to stop him from quoting Simpsons every time he steps into a church type of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations. I mean, it's just a thing, and it really comes from the fact that we grew up in the 90s, and it would be, I think we'd be remiss not to mention that something like Beavis and Butthead is the thing that existed in the 90s beginning in 1990, and it became synonymous with that entire generation. And yeah. Roger Ebert's not wrong. It was people missing the message for the messengers a lot of the time. still watching this movie. And, you know, I was forbidden from seeing it when I was 10. I didn't see this movie until May 25th, 2015. That was the first time I saw Beavis and Butthead Do America. And I know that because I was supposed to come out and visit you. And 5 hours into the drive, I got violently ill at a rest area in Pennsylvania. And my thought was, so I can drive 5 more hours towards Seijin, possibly be miserable, and have to drive 10 hours home. And then I or just drive home those five hours.
Yep.
And
to be fair, who has not been violently ill in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, but it's so big. It's so, even if you're thinking, oh, I can hold it till Virginia.
We all got super sick.
In New Jersey, that was New Jersey though. It was in Pennsylvania. We had White Castle in New Jersey, and it was 15 minutes later that the four of us destroyed that rest area bathroom. I think it's the Thomas Edison rest area. It's one of those ridiculous ones that's in the middle of the highway.
And I just sat there cursing John Cho.
Poor.
You, Kelvin.
Yeah. But it's just one of those situations where, like,
you're still a boy.
But I will say this. Revelations, and maybe I've revealed this before. One of the other reasons I was going out to you is I had a potential job interview also in Ohio, and I never told you about that. The next day, I ended up driving out to Ohio for a job interview. Did not get the job. Had a great time. Got to spend some time with some good people. But then, like, the position just was not better than what I was currently doing. And drove back.
I think you told me the story. Wasn't Pete Holmes somewhere in the story eventually?
It was a comedian. It was Jeff Tate. It was Jeff Tate and that whole situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I believe I told it to you, but I don't know if I've ever told it on the show. But it's weirdly related to this movie that we're now putting into our own personal canon of the Say Report. Yeah. And I wanted to just get how it's attacked. And then going home, and after, you know, at that point, a 20-hour round-trip drive, and I never got to see you, right, which was the true thing. But then luckily fate intervened and I popped a tire that September, and we wound up stuck in Bowling Green with you for 3 extra days.
Yep.
And, you know, the rest is history, as they say. We're doing a podcast, and you're advising Will on bathing techniques.
Also, you're the only person to ever complete Zeo Drifter on my PS4. But yeah. A lot of that happened in that weekend.
Oh, I'm sorry. You should beat
Zeo
Drifter.
No, it's good. No, I was just laughing because I think I have a trophy on there that I did not earn. But it's really funny that you're talking about all this, the driving stuff.
Yeah.
Because that, so for anybody that's never seen Beavis and Butthead Do America, it is a road trip movie. Like at its heart, it is the classic, like, well, we need a reason to stay with these characters for an hour and a half versus the 20 minutes we normally do. Well, let's put them on the road, right? Like, and it's another example of somebody making a movie that just loves movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like Mike Judge clearly just has a love of film and television, and you know, this is where the kind of the DNA of Beavis and Butthead really kind of starts to kind of be put on the table and examined, right? Mm-hmm. Is the love of film, the love of television, the love of music that is on display in this movie is balanced so beautifully against the idea that this is the most, like, if boomer humor existed in the 90s, like, this is the most boomer-esque view of all of that. And Mike Judge at this point is only in his late 20s. Like, he's not an old man, like, looking back at kids being like, "God damn kids, like, get off my music lawn." Like, he's in it. He's one of us in this movie when he's making Beavis and Butthead.
He's not one of us. Like, he's one of Gen X. Because the target audience for this movie is Generation X. Yeah, Beavis and Butthead are, like, two post... If there was a Gen X Mount Rushmore, Beavis and Butthead would share a location somehow, aping the weird animation style of this show.
With Kurt Cobain as like a third one up there, for sure. Yeah. Like I don't disagree. I also want to say right here and now, can somebody from Gen X just fucking adopt me into that generation? I hate the idea that you and I technically qualify as quote unquote millennials, because anytime anybody talks about Gen X, like, I'm like, yeah, I was there for that. And they're like, yeah, but you don't count. And then anytime somebody talks about millennial shit, they're like, you should have been here for this. And I'm like, was, but I didn't pay attention. I'm sorry. Like, I get that, like, numbers-wise, this is where I fit. But, like, my heart is definitely with you, Gen X. Like, I want that to be clear here as we start to talk about this stuff.
I mean, you could start being one of those people who defined yourself as an Xennial.
Oh, God.
Where
I'm not.
You're in the fringe between the two. And I
start to get very much on the verge of those people that are like, I'm transracial, I've decided, and I cannot even broach
I know.
That
Xennial is one of those phrases, first of all, I never thought we'd say on this show. But then second of all, I find it difficult to subscribe to it because, like, let's be honest, the generations, there are defined, like, rules for what a generation is.
Right, and as a millennial, like, I will take full, like, credit as being there when, like, the Iraq War started and my friends were the ones going to Afghanistan. So, like, all of this talk all of a sudden about, like, hey, the Afghan War ended. By the way, we're recording this right after that bullshit. But all of that stuff, like, I'm there for that conversation. So, yeah, I'm a millennial for that. But when you start talking about, like, movies and music, I'm just like, I wasn't in on the fucking, like, Midwest emo scene or whatever bullshit came around in the 2000s, like, that just wasn't my jam. And it's fine. If that's what your shit was, that's what your shit was. It's just not my shit. And so I can't define myself by it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, like, clearly, we were defining ourselves based on the slacker mentalities on display in things like the work of Kevin Smith and Mike Judge, which is why we're doing this episode on Beavis and Butthead Do America. Because in the grand scope of things, you know what? The adjective I found myself using the most while taking notes on this film was pure. This moment is pure 90s. This is a pure moment of what was happening in 1996. Like, it's distilled out.
I think that's the trick for Mike Judge, though, right? Yeah. Like, as a comedian, as a writer, as a creator, like, the thing that works for him is, no matter how much his thing may be quote unquote problematic, because you can talk about like the weirdly, like, overtly sexual stuff that goes on in this movie. I won't call it sexist, but there's definitely sexual stuff that goes on, right? And there's all sorts of really, like, on the nose shit about, like, kids versus adults. But then there's also really a lot of moments where we see the adults act like children. Like, there's a purity to all of it. There is a verisimilitude, to use a big word, that is present in all of his fucking work that you have to respect whether or not you agree with him. You know, you and I were talking about doing this episode, and I said, like, look, I'm going to talk about other Mike Judge stuff. It's just going to happen because, like, you don't talk about the creation of Mike Judge and the MTV generation with Beavis and Butthead and not focus on the fact that the guy goes on to make definitive movies for us, not just Office Space that I mentioned earlier, but, like, nobody can go a fucking second without mentioning Idiocracy.
Well, because we're living, like, in Idiocracy right now. I'm surprised that I don't have Mountain Dew.
That was, like, the opening moments of Idiocracy. Like, I, like, no joke, like, August 24th, 2021, look at the top of Reddit, and I guarantee you that there's an Idiocracy, like, scene on display. So, yeah, so, like, the guy is here, the guy is present, the guy is all around us. And I think the reason that that happens is because, no matter whether or not you stand by him as, like, a person, whether or not you stand by everything he has to say in his shit, at the end of the day, he's never speaking from a place of falsehood. Like, he's never over-exaggerating, funny enough. He's never, ever, like, pointing out something that isn't somewhat based in a reality that we all kind of have to admit to, right? And that is kind of the joy. So you said pure earlier. I'm going to say that the thing that I felt the entire time I watched this movie was kind of pure joy. Just because the entire moment, like, I was giggling like one of these two fucking idiots in this movie. Like, there was never a moment where I didn't just have a little bit of a smile on my face watching Beavis and Butthead.
I mean, the only moment, it's because I wrote it in my notes, is the saddest part is that Mike Judge completely captures the slacker horn dog attitudes of the youth at the time. Yeah. And, like, and that's not a negative against the people that were between the ages of 14 and 17 in the 90s, right? That I couldn't really lock down an age on Beavis and or Butthead. The Wikipedia says they are between 14 and 17.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. That works for me. That honestly works for me. And it, like, it really just sort of distills down exactly how they were acting, but because of how society around them had shaped them to be, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. There was... I mean, they had gone through a recession in 1992, right? After all of the excess of the 80s, right? So why would you want to do anything, right? Because you've just been told that doing things sometimes still leads to you having nothing.
Well, and the really dangerous mentality is they went through a recession, and I'm going to put quotes around that because mm-hmm. as a millennial, yeah. I will take it
for, we went I through say, a more of a recession.
Yeah. But to that point, right, the idea that we went through a recession and then we were pulled out of a tailspin right quick and became affluent as fuck for the rest of the 90s. So there was kind of this untouchable attitude. So not only did we see like, hey, all of this is kind of meaningless, we also learned that we were kind of the kings of meaningless here in America. So the idea that it is Beavis and Butthead do America, and we're watching these two guys that have not a care in the fucking world, because no matter what happens, they're going to be taken care of and they'll be fine, as these two 17-year-old white dudes coming out of God knows where in California, for all I can tell, like, that's, this is it, right? Like, they are set for fucking life, and they know it.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. They do this thing in the beginning of the movie where they're expelled from school so that there are no consequences for right. for this adventure, right?
Right.
They go to school. They try to see. Okay, so the inciting action of this movie, right, is that Russ and Hart.
One of the funniest fucking moments in the whole movie. Like, as much joy as I felt for this movie, very little of it made me laugh out loud. But fuck me. Yes, the opening moments of this movie made me laugh out loud. Sorry.
Yeah, no, and they should. Ross and Harlan, two, like, known secondary characters from the show who, like, commit acts of theft and vandalism, finally come to the house of Beavis and Butthead and steal their television. And since Beavis and Butthead, really all they do, and that's not true, because they have their job at the burger place and they sometimes go to school, but, like, primarily, they spend their time sitting on the couch, kind of riffing on television, right? In a lot of ways, Beavis and Butthead were the original podcasters. They just didn't have microphones in front of them.
Yeah.
And they would riff on TV and music and everything that was going on because their window to the world was that television. So when the movie starts and their television is stolen, they're forced to actually go out into the world. And that's what gets, you know, where they get involved, and then they're suddenly doing America. But their first stop is to go to the high school and steal the Goliath, the behemoth, the AV cart television that mm-hmm. every kid in the 90s knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And it was a different vibe if you walked into the classroom and it was there. And that's their goal is like, well, we know there's a TV at the school. Let's go get that TV. And they drop it down the stairs because it's the 90s, so not everywhere is handicap accessible yet, right? We started it, but we hadn't yet succeeded in that goal. So they drop that cart down the stairs and they break the television, and their principal says, "That's it, you boys are expelled." So then they are free and untethered and can go anywhere because you know there's never going to be that moment where, like, Ed Rooney is going to be chasing them down for their day off.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's a sense of just anything can happen at that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the moment specifically that just made me almost literally lose my shit, like almost had to pause and go to the bathroom because I was laughing so hard I almost threw up. The moment when they are trying to figure out what happened to the TV and Butthead is just like looking at the window, looking at the footsteps, looking at the spot where the TV is, looking at the door, looking at the window, and they just keep fucking doing it. And like, I just kept laughing and it kept happening. And I was laughing harder and harder. And the hardest part was the thing that really kind of probably is what made me sick is it was 8 o'clock in the fucking morning here. So everybody else is still fucking in bed before they have to get up for work, including the goddamn dogs. So I'm like trying not to laugh like a goddamn idiot down here in the basement as I'm watching this thing. And so I'm like holding in this, like this guffaw and like watching this and it just keeps fucking going. And from that moment on, I don't think anything else in the movie made me laugh that hard, but only because I think I had accidentally just gotten it all out in the first 10 minutes of this film.
Yeah, that sucks more than anything has ever sucked before, CJ.
So that happens, and like that is quintessential like Beavis and Butthead nonsense, right? Like, because the idea that like they kind of figure it out, but they don't quite, and then it just leads on the adventure, right? And then it's somehow fucking Bruce Willis and Demi Moore show up.
Well, so yeah, so without a TV and they're forced to go out into the world, their first attempt, so then they're just walking around and they see a motel. And the motel advertising, which was very like, it was the thing to do in the 90s, was to advertise, our hotel has television.
Has cable, right? Like, yeah. That was always, we have HBO.
We have HBO.
It was like a huge thing. Yeah. It was like a, yeah.
Uh-huh. It's one of those situations. So then they're like, oh, they have TVs here. So then they start trying to break into rooms. They see the principal again so that we get that reminder that these two are untethered. Because he expels them for walking in on him, getting spanked by a prostitute.
Yeah, right. They show up and they find him again, yeah.
And then the next room is where we find Bruce Willis, not credited during the theatrical release, later credited on the home video release. And he is looking for two guys who are supposed to come and agree to kill his wife for him. So then these two show up and he's drunk off his ass. He's probably has some other stuff in his system as well. And he just assumes that naturally these two guys are the hitmen that he's supposed to be hiring to kill his wife.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, you just because you just offhandedly mentioned this, I think this might be another one of those movies, and I'm only kind of foiled by the peyote scene later, but, like, the idea that drugs are not addressed in this film, this is one of the earliest things, examples I can think of, because I've brought this up on the show before, of a time in which movies were made where the characters would clearly be using drugs. Like, that would just be part of the conversation, even if it is for them to say, no, I don't do that. But the fact that, like, marijuana is never once mentioned in this movie is insane to me. Because, like, Beavis and Butthead alone, the fact that that is not part of their, like, oeuvre, that they get high and watch TV, is fucking bizarre. Like, they talk about the idea of trying to get a hold of booze. The fact that they don't also try and get a hold of, like, any other drug, but weed specifically, is weird to me. And then you point out this character that Bruce Willis is playing, Muddy Waters, I think is his name.
Muddy Grimes is his name.
Muddy Grimes. Yeah. Muddy Grimes. Yeah. Muddy Grimes. You mentioned he was uncredited, by the way, and I don't know if without the credit I could have told you that was Bruce Willis, yeah, but, like, there's a couple of moments where you hear Bruce Willis, but other than that, like, pretty damn.
It's one of those where I'm like, I know this is significant, and it wasn't until I heard Dallas Grimes' voice, and as I've mentioned, I'm a big Demi Moore fan. You kind of get out of the Decker household without being a Demi Moore fan. And I'm like, oh, is that Demi Moore? So it must be Bruce Willis who's playing her husband, because it's that extra level of meta humor that Mike Judge is just constantly pouring into his art.
Yeah, well, and the thing is like, Bruce Willis, it's interesting to me that he does not want to be credited with this, because you know one of his favorite go-to jokes from as early as, like, Moonlighting and Hudson Hawk, and like, and then like later, is he loves making jokes about Beavis and Butthead and calling people Butthead and things like that. Like, it is a go-to thing. So you know, at the end of the day, that motherfucker is like drinking a tall boy, smoking a blunt, and watching Beavis and Butthead on a regular basis is the real secret behind those jokes, right? So I'm surprised he did not want to be credited in this movie, because I would probably bet he's a fan.
I don't know. I wonder if it's a question of if he wants to be credited or not, only because of David Letterman getting to choose how he was credited as Motley Crue, roadie number two.
Yeah, he's one of those guys.
He's one of their fathers. Is really spoilers for
Butthead's
25-year-old.
Yeah, like, he's the spoiler for later, but we see him and he is so very clearly Butthead's dad. Yeah,
yeah. And that's just one of the situations that happens in the film. So I wonder if it was one of those moments of, like, do you want to be credited here? And he's like, I also don't think they wanted to sell this movie on anything but Beavis and Butthead. Knowing that Mike Judge is kind of over the characters, I feel like it's one of those situations where he doesn't want the marketing to say Bruce Willis and Demi Moore in Beavis and Butthead Do America, because it legitimizes it again. That same sort of thought process that I had at 10 years old of like, well, now they're getting a movie, so it means that it's more than just some stupid show that we're supposed to be afraid of on MTV. It has some cultural significance. Demi Moore and Bruce Willis, at the time, they're the Hollywood it couple, right?
Yeah.
So you see that they sign off on Beavis and Butthead. It could have made MTV say, yeah, you know how we said that it's the movie in one more season? We're going to need three more seasons out of you, Mike.
Yeah.
Because you've never been hotter.
Well, and so there's this idea that him as an artist, he wants to move on. He wants to do A, B, and C. He doesn't love the idea that people are emulating these characters in a way he didn't intend and all that sort of stuff, right? But I think this also kind of speaks to a larger thing about him that goes forward even until now, where, like, we joked about him being, like, the king of an empire. But as I said, it's a very kind of, like, subtle, like, neutral one. It's because, like, the entire concept of celebrity, I would never attribute that to Mike Judge. Like, he's not the guy that shows up on Letterman to do interviews when this movie comes out. He's not the guy years later after making movie after movie that are all culturally successful enough that we literally reference them in tweets to the president. Trump just kind of flew out there somewhere in the tweet and president over where my mind went. But the idea being that, I mean, he has the power currently to hold over all of us as a celebrity, but he's never chosen to use it. And I don't think that that's his jam. I think he very much wants to just be the guy that buys a house in Texas whose neighbor comes over and fixes his fence and all that sort of shit, right? Like, I think that's kind of the person he's always wanted to be. And so the success and the misinterpreting of his art becomes probably kind of not fun anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely a guy who, he wants to be known for his art and really nothing else. He's not one of these artists who then will go out and be like, I'm Mike Judge, and here's the other thing. Like, he would never do what Dan Harmon did, where Dan Harmon had a podcast playing Dungeons & Dragons, because his Dungeons & Dragons episode of Community hit as well as it did. Like, he's like, no, I for Mike Judge, I'll do the episode about Dungeons & Dragons. People will love it, but, like, there's my story about Dungeons & Dragons. On to the next. Like, he always knows that there's another, like, kingdom to conquer, and he's willing to move on and then just let the art speak for itself. So you're not wrong. I mean, like, celebrity, it doesn't seem like it's one of those things that he cares about, and it's one of those things that helps to make his work genuine. Yeah. And, I mean, we haven't talked about it, but The Good Family, it's kind of the redheaded stepchild, the black sheep of the Judge empire.
And if there could be one, like, at the end of the day, I feel like I hear about it as much and as little as I hear about other projects that he has worked on, right? Like versus, you know, minus maybe like King of the Hill. Like, let's just put that up on the pedestal now and then walk away from it. Like, King of the Hill is the thing that he is probably going to be remembered for the rest of his life, right? But like I think about The Good Family on the same level as something like Extract, which is actually probably my favorite movie from him, but nobody fucking ever talks about it.
Exactly.
But sorry, but like, to what you're saying, like, The Good Family is kind of kept kind of in the closet still when we talk about him, for sure.
And I think one of the main reasons why it's kept in the closet is because ABC's marketing for that was so Mike Judge forward, and it's so different compared to everything else that he's ever worked on. I mean, King of the Hill was a show that was basically, like, doomed to relegation and preemption, right? And Mike Judge was never upset about that. King of the Hill still runs for 17 seasons, despite it being the show that, like, maybe you'll get to watch this week's new episode, or maybe the football game will go long. And honestly, it's more, you might be able to watch an episode this week if the football game doesn't go long. The football game going long,
Hank would rather you watch the football game.
Yeah. I'd rather you be supporting the Dallas Cowboys than watching me try to deal with Dale Boomhauer and the other one whose name I forgot, and I'm very upset about it. You know, the bald one who's probably my son's real father.
God damn it, Bill.
God damn it, Bill. How come I couldn't remember your name? It's one of those situations, but, like, That being said,
God, Lord's name in vain. I need to stop us right now before we get the tweets.
God dang it! God dang it, Bill!
Yeah.
Why are you dressed like a woman?
Still one of the best episodes of that show, by the way.
Oh, it's fantastic! I mean, the show's amazing. I mean, King of the Hill is amazing, and like one of the enduring things about King of the Hill is that even though there are probably episodes that I still haven't seen, despite owning DVDs and watching it on streaming, just because of like they just passed me by in the quantum overflow of the 7:30 on Sunday night of Fox of it all, and still. We look at King of the Hill and say that is probably his most prolific and what will be remembered when Mike Judge is no longer with us.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's crazy, especially considering he did something like Beavis and Butthead, which was groundbreaking and incendiary and really had all of the Christian and Catholic mothers in this country grasping their pearls. So it's nuts that then you've got King of the Hill, but then you look at something like The Good Family, and this is really more speaking towards the celebrity aspect of it all. ABC gets their hands on Mike Judge, and they're going to treat this show completely different from how King of the Hill was treated. We're going to make sure that you are on a night where you will never be preempted. If we say there's going to be an episode of The Good Family, we're showing an episode of The Good Family. And in all of the marketing, it is Mike Judge's The Good Family. And I feel like that, those airs that ABC put upon the show, is one of the main reasons why it never went much further than 13 episodes.
Yeah, I think that that's definitely a huge part of it. I think it's also, it's worth pointing out that Judge is the kind of guy that will sit around and look at the world around him and see who's getting a fair shake and who's not. And he'll go after he'll try and it's weird because like King of the Hill comes around at a time when like conservatives are an easy target. And what he does with King of the Hill is he shows that there are good people on that side of the conversation. Right. And the same goes for Beavis and Butthead. It's like Beavis and Butthead really like you can give all the shit in the world to Beavis and Butthead, but what that show did is it took a lot of people that were ready to shit all over the kids of the 90s because they had it easy and didn't know, you know, they didn't know a care in the world, and he shows that, but then what he shows is that, look, it's the world around them that's making them this way. And so you apply that to King of the Hill, right? And I think the problem with The Good Family is that he tries to do that, but I think we already all kind of were on that ride with him. So, like, this is when it starts to feel a little, like, on the nose, and it's just like, no, we get it. And I feel like what The Good Family fails in as a show, Silicon Valley ends up super succeeding, because he shows us that same kind of, like new age, overwoke, high into like the tech world, like we are progressing, not necessarily progressive, but like this is the world as it's progressing, while also showing you that like sometimes this progress is going to run over some people's toes, like, right? Which is what The Good Family attempts to do, but it doesn't quite hit as well as some of his later work ends up doing. It's really weird because like I do think that The Good Family suffers from the ways in which it's marketed, from the ways in which it's made, too much studio involvement, too much of of everybody kind of getting on board too fast before we gave it a chance to kind of grow into its own thing. Because that's the other benefit of like, I mean, you talk about Beavis and Butthead starting on MTV in 1990. Yes, MTV was huge in 1990, but being a show that had a couple of music videos, but then otherwise was an animated show on the music television network at the time was fucking like a risk and crazy, which is why it was late night MTV, right? Like Adult Swim was still a decade out from being a fucking thing. The idea that this was what they were going to do was fucking wild, which is what, you know, which is what MTV did, like, you know, so that wasn't too crazy. And then the idea of doing King of the Hill, where they were going to show a conservative family in Texas, but show them that, like, you know, humanize them, was like, that was a huge risk, right? Like, so there's also that element to the whole thing, that what Mike Judge does is he's not afraid to dive into these groups that are, they're not like, in the definition, in the in the textbook definition, in the Webster's Dictionary, they define like the idea of marginalized other as. So these people qualify as that, but they're not the first people that we would point to nor go to bat for as marginalized others, because like while like culture, pop culture may be marginalizing them, like the world isn't. Right, like Hank Hill. At the end of the day, while he is a rarity in our eyes as like liberal others, like he's well off. He's not doing too bad for himself. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he has a great family. He has a great he does a great job. He's doing okay for himself. He's not in danger of like the world crumbling around him if he's not careful, right? And the same goes for Beavis and Butthead. I don't love these guys, but I have to admit that like they're gonna be okay probably because of the way the world works. And you know, and so, and the same goes for the Good Family. Is at the end of the day, like, it's hard for me to like feel bad for them, and it's hard for me to kind of view them as marginalized others. Whereas like if I step back and think about it, the textbook definition of that, like, clearly they are on the extreme, they are on the margin, like there is that concept to it. So it's just a weird thing, but not too out of step for him, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. And I also think, since you then bring up Silicon Valley, that the Good Family really came along too early.
Yeah.
And it's one of the only examples in his entire career and, well, empire, right? That's the word that we've been using for it, where that happens.
Yeah.
Everything else, he kind of gets like, this is the time to do this. And then, I mean, what I really do dig, right, and especially watching this movie, you see Tom Anderson and you see how Tom Anderson evolves into Hank Hill. And
yeah.
Then seeing Van Dryzen, and it's like, oh, wow, that's just the dad from The Good Family. It's as if their teacher went off and had a family and everything
yeah.
that they had to deal with as a result of that. But it really, it comes along way too early. Like, if he were going to introduce the Good Family now as, like, we can't find a host for Jeopardy because everybody has a past, which really kind of, you know, breaks it down to the lowest level. But, like,
yeah.
It does feel like if they don't give it to LeVar Burton, whoever they choose, something from that they said in their past is going to come out so that it can be defeated and the pathway can be opened up for LeVar Burton.
No, you give it to Ken Jennings because we already all know that what a dick he is.
Yeah. That's, I mean, you're not wrong about that.
I want to pose a different theory, though.
Yeah.
I think that his timeline for how he normally introduces these characters and then we eventually fall in love and recognize the genius of them is pretty standard, including The Good Family. Getting a season's worth of that show and not quite still being there with them yet is perfectly acceptable earlier in Judge's career. I think what happens is that we hit a point in television where if you're not on fucking fire in the first season, then we can't keep you around. We get Beavis and Butthead in 1990, and it really isn't until later in that series where we really start to appreciate the genius of what that show is doing. And the same goes for King of the Hill. It starts in the 90s, but really it's not until we get into like the Bush era that like a lot of us could look back and be like, oh right, yeah, we really, this was something we should have been paying attention to. So like I feel like The Good Family comes along as far as Mike Judge timelines go at just the right moment, and it just needed 2 or 3 years before we all started to realize that he was just kind of like showing us what we kind of been feeling for a while. We just couldn't put words to it. And I think it's just that because it is a network that he is not accustomed to, because it is an audience that he is not accustomed to, it doesn't get the chance that those earlier works of his do.
That's a good point. Also, if we ever wanted to have just a kind of disappointing episode of the Sarah Report, like one that would, like, you want to get bummed out, listen to the next hour and a half of Devin and Siegen talking.
Which is great for audio.
Yeah, great, you know, great for that.
Yeah.
But like exploring the history of ABC and adult animation,
yeah.
Like why would you ever agree to go to that? Like they had to have offered him everything and more. For him to ignore the way that they treated Clerks, the way that they treated, honestly, I can't think of...
God the Devil and Bob was them, too, right?
God the Devil and Bob was NBC.
NBC.
Yeah. But it's just, like, one of those situations where, like, Fox was the place to go with an animated sitcom.
I mean,
and even then,
if you were
going
to be network, you were going to be network, like ABC was not the way to go. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, ABC has more of the examples. Like, I just want to make sure that I'm not like pointing to NBC because, like, Father of the Pride is NBC. Those more jump to mind, but ABC had them too. I mean, like The Critic. Like getting the season and then having to get picked up and rescued by Comedy Central. It's just one of those situations where like ABC really wanted to try to appeal to everybody. And that was sort of their messaging. So like, we'll try to do the animated show. And like, that's not what people watching ABC wanted. They wanted the TGIF where all of the shows could intersect and sort of aped the magical realism of 70s sitcoms. So it's so strange also that The Good Family, in the time it came out, because it's like 2008, right?
I'll give you one that you can't think of.
Is it
Slacker Cats?
Oh, God. I was thinking Family Dog. Family Dog kept jumping to my head, but like I don't remember enough of Family Dog. So we're never going to do an extremely depressing episode of the Say Report celebrating ABC primetime animation. This is your little slice of that hidden here in the middle section of the time capsule about Beavis and Butthead to America.
And you want to talk about like what was going on at Fox at the time, just to kind of tell everybody what was happening is that while The Good Family was kind of falling on its face over there on ABC, as well as a couple of other animated shows, Fox was still going strong with stuff like the PJs, the Eddie Murphy Claymation, which, God, that must have cost them a fucking fortune between having Murphy on board and Claymation as a medium, like, which was, like, just crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I mean, but, like, even that, like, The Good Family, you have a built-in audience on Adult Swim, and it's at a time where Adult Swim is looking for more half-hour series. Like, we've already proven that we can do it with the 11-minute stuff. We want to try to do more half-hour stuff that's in our studio. That's not Family Guy or reruns of Futurama. So, like, if he had gone there with the built-in audience, because I remember when they lost Futurama and picked up King of the Hill, that, like, everybody made that transition flawlessly. Like, there was a time when we were in college where, like, I could have conversations about King of the Hill again. And it was insane to me. Because I never thought that world would happen.
Yeah, man. It's just fucking wild. And then, like, you know, you add to all of this the movie career that's going on alongside this. I mean, like, Office Space became just basic vernacular for anybody going to college in the 2000s. You know, and then Idiocracy has the balls to come along in 2006. Alma balls. In 2006, and that just like that just fucking takes off. You know, like there's all of this shit that Judge just puts his hands on, and it becomes such weirdly like cultural gold that, you know, everybody just seems to be happy with. It's a wild thing for like a guy doing this caliber of television, this style of comedy, to just be kind of just in everybody's, you know, on everybody's good side.
Yeah. I still can't believe that there were 17 years of King of the Hill. And it sucks so much about Brittany Murphy because, like, that pallor is over it every time you watch it. Because what she did with Luann is, like, next level.
But the best part about that is it's a celebration of her. Because the love that show has for Luann is unmeasurable. Like it is unparalleled in any other television show, the way in which that character is introduced as a foil for Hank in the first season, but like instantly, like the ways in which Hank Hill deals with Luann as a character and we as a nation come to like love her, it's fucking wild, right? Like the ways in which he treats that character over that entire series is just unmatched in any other animated show out there.
I didn't expect to cry during this.
Yeah.
But that episode where he takes her to vote for the first time is just like tattooed on my heart for just how much he cares about her and wants her to understand patriotic duty in this world.
And that's what Mike Judge does, right? Like, he takes these unassuming figures and he shows us these really weird, these really bizarre, stock characters. I mean, I can't think of the word right now, but like, they are these versions of these characters that we all kind of come to assume are going to be shown to us, and then he gets into them, right? And he gets weird and he gets deep with them. And the ways in which that manifests itself in Beavis and Butthead are not nearly as clear as later in his career, but they're there. Like, the fucking insanity that goes on in this movie is proof enough of that. So you pointed out the stuff that happens to them at school, like where they show up just to get the TV and they're fucking idiots. And they've got that one teacher that really is trying to, like, kind of, you know, motivate them and push them in one direction. Then you've got their principal who is not, right? But then later in the movie, as we hinted at earlier, they straight up eventually get to meet their fathers for a moment in this film. And they get to meet these two guys that like begot them, and we learn what assholes they are, right? And like, it's just, it's fucking wild to me. And the depth in which we go into the characters of Beavis and Butthead in the movie alone is unnecessary, but we do.
You're not wrong. I mean, that scene where they meet their fathers, it's so interesting in terms of the thesis that I feel Judge has on display for Beavis and Butthead as a whole, that, like, these kids only act this way because of the influence of society around them, the whole nurture argument. So then to meet their fathers, and that, like, by nature, it feels like this is where these two were always meant to wind up. That's, like, a really interesting statement to make in this film.
Yeah, well, so nature versus nurture, right? Like, so the idea behind Beavis and Butthead has always kind of been like, look, society has never allowed them to be more than this. And then to meet their fathers and realize that nature wasn't going to fucking help either is a punch in the gut to the entire concept of everything we've thought about Beavis and Butthead up until that point, right? Yeah. Like, if we're supposed to be believing that, like, society as a whole has let these two dudes down and allowed them become these assholes that we now love, but the idea that nature was also involved and also just as criminal in that is a moment of, like, reflection that, like, we don't even give – the movie doesn't give us time to actually think about, because literally they wake up the next day and those two guys have driven off. So were they ever really there? We don't even fucking know,
right?
Yeah,
I'm so happy. The only reason why, like, they have to have been there is that secondary characters parallel to them meeting their fathers are having discussions and showing photos of them. So that we can, so that we get that confirmation that, like, this isn't an example of these two people potentially meeting future versions of themselves in some sort of vision quest in the desert. This is for real, Beavis and Butthead finally coming face to face with their fathers.
Yeah.
And seeing you guys were kind of doomed from the go.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, when Butthead's dad is just like, I scored with two chicks, true story. And it's just like, oh my God, you've never met this man and you already talk like him.
Yeah. But, and there's also this phenomenal idea that, like, okay, so nurture is the problem, nature didn't help, but also in reverse, like, clearly nature was the problem and nurture didn't help. Like, nobody did their due diligence in this case. So it is that moment of really true cynicism where nothing was in their favor the entire time.
Right. Except for the fact that they kind of live consequence-free despite that. It also says a lot that David Letterman portrays one of the fathers, in so much that, like, that's what late night talk show hosts were doing at the time. So way, they are the forebearers of the cultural and social commentary that Beavis and Butthead began to deliver to us on MTV.
Oh man, like, that's a deep thought. That's
one of those thoughts that I'm driving home and I'm like, oh, I need to look at the road again, because I've gone off down a pathway in my mind and I'm driving right now.
Well, but if we're going to get this deep, right? So yeah, I should talk about, like, the the one thing that I truly remember about Beavis and Butthead in my youth, and the reason I didn't bring it up earlier is because it's not truly them, but it shows just how kind of deep this vein ran in the world. I didn't ever truly watch Beavis and Butthead. Like, you know, offhandedly saw it, you know, and saw t-shirts and saw, you know, late night at my cousin's house and stuff like that. But never, like, sat down to watch Beavis and Butthead. But I think I was well enough aware that I laughed my ass off when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, 7 years old. Went to go see a production of all fucking things, Godspell. And if you know anything about that show, it is slightly adaptable. And what they did is, for one of them, I couldn't even tell you which parable they choose. Like, Farmer and the Seed, I don't know. It's Cain and Abel in that show, I don't know. They decided to portray two characters as Beavis and Butthead. Like, that was the joke, is that they were Beavis and Butthead, but, like, in a biblical parable. Right, yeah, like, the laughs, the jokes, the slapping each other type shit, like all of that was on display. And I got it. Like, I loved it. I thought it was hilarious that they chose Beavis and Butthead in this Catholic show that I got dragged to, right? And I fucking hate Godspell for so many reasons.
I think if you love theater, you hate Godspell. I think it unfortunately goes hand in hand.
That was present. So that in my head, that is Beavis and Butthead, right? So to that, watching this movie and seeing them like going through the desert, potentially meeting their fathers, the entire time I'm just thinking like, well, Beavis and Butthead are just a parable for these life lessons we're supposed to learn, right? And so like you going this deep with them and the idea of like David Letterman playing one of their fathers being this commentary on late night television being the forebearer to MTV culture and all that shit, like, yeah, man, I'm right there with you. Like, considering I was already considering it on a biblical level, I'm right there. Like, I'm there.
Yeah, I'm 2,000 years ago. You bringing it like 5 years earlier? That's a little easier for me to swallow.
Yeah.
I want that. I know that. I'm sure that Beavis and Butthead Do America 2 is already in the works, and that. But if it's not, Beavis and Butthead Do the Bible, I would be all for. She's a virgin, Butthead.
Oh, man.
I mean, she's never had sex. We've never had sex, Beavis. Like, I don't, I just, it would, that would really work for me, putting them in there.
Yeah, man. But that's the idea, right? And so going back to the first thing we even talked about at the beginning of all of this, the idea that Beavis and Butthead are not figures to be looked at and watched with like reverence or anything like that, because they're not human. They're not actual people. They're just a metaphor for what people are at this time. And so there's even the joke later on where they get on the intercom at Congress and make the comment about like looking for the chick with boobs, and we hear all of Congress laugh like them with like the giggles. So like there's this moment of even all of these dudes that are running the country are just basically Beavis and Butthead, right? Like that commentary, that idea that we are all in some little way, a little piece of us is Beavis and Butthead, right? Is like the full on point of all of this, right? And so with that, the story, the concept of like don't shoot the messenger, like this is just Mike Judge showing us a piece of ourselves that we might not love, like you gotta be on board with that. And I am starting to really kind of fall down a rabbit hole here, Dev, because I just said on our last full episode, like, I have yet to find the Rosetta Stone of 90s filmmaking, but this might be it. Like this realization, this moment, this thing that unlocks the idea that throughout the 90s we didn't have protagonists and heroes. We had these people that we were supposed to learn to not be like. And that's the problem that we all have with 90s filmmaking. The reason we look back and go everything was sucked is because, yeah, everything sucked because we were supposed to not want to be like that anymore. It was all of these filmmakers and these artists telling us, like, here's an example of terrible people you don't want to be like. And then we gave them Oscars.
Yeah. Well, also, like, what are we supposed to be like? You produce all of these films where the message is, this is not what you should aspire to be, but you never give us a character to aspire to be like. You don't give us, I'm going to say moral oral, but I mean like Davy of Davy and Goliath. We don't ever have that person who, like, so don't be like Goofus, be like Gallant. we're only ever shown goofuses, and we're left, and they treat us like we're intelligent enough to be able to discern how to be the gallant version of the goofus characters.
Yeah.
But, like, no.
I will say, though, that, like, a decade of filmmaking out of the, at this point, a century of filmmaking, and, like, a decade of humanity out of God knows how long, right? Nor, you know, science knows how long, of this whole thing. Like, this idea that we had a decade where we didn't know the answers to that question. So what we spent the time doing was at least being, look, I don't know what a good person looks like, but I know what a terrible person looks like, and don't be that. I can start to kind of forgive that, right? And so, like, we look at these 90s movies, and the problem is that, like, I don't know, maybe we all needed to get, like, a film theory 101 class in high school to really tell us how to parse these things, but too many people started to latch on to these characters, like Beavis and Butthead, like Dante and Randall, like you know, like, I mean, mm-hmm. even going into the late 90s with guys like fucking Jerry Maguire, and the idea that everybody wanted to be him, and everybody wanted to be Cuba Gooding Jr. in that movie, and you're just like, no, like, these are not the people you want to be. It's like looking at Gordon Gekko in the 90s and saying, we all did that too, right? Like, that idea that we wanted to become these figures because we didn't realize that the point was that we weren't supposed to be them. And I don't know, like, maybe that's a failure on these artists' parts, and maybe they got better later in their careers, but also, like, maybe that's just a failure on us for just not being able to fucking read the room.
I mean, I think what it talks about, if we're going to go, like, purely existential on it, is that as a culture, as a species, we had gotten to the point in it where we're like, we don't know the answer. We don't know the answer to what a good person is, but we have volumes and volumes about what a bad person is. And maybe if we highlight what we shouldn't be doing, we can solve the problem of how to be a good person.
Well, and that's why King of the Hill ends up being about Hank Hill and not Tom Anderson, right? Like, we get a show that is similar, but eventually completely divorced from anything that Judge does with Beavis and Butthead in King of the Hill. And we are shown good people. We are shown an immense wealth of people trying to do the right thing. And, you know, a number of them failing, but a number of them succeeding throughout that show. So, as I was saying, the evolution of these artists and whether or not they got better later in their careers is definitely something to be discussed. But I think as we sit here talking about Mike Judge today, looking at his later work, we can start to see that, right? And it's not that he ever kind of gets away from the idea of questioning, like, what makes a person a good person, because we see that on display in Office Space, in Idiocracy, in Extract, and in even in his later work, in The Good Family, Silicon Valley, which is basically, as far as I'm concerned, like Mike Judge does his own Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. Like, it is basically the idea of watching a good guy come up against all of these things that should turn him into a terrible person and how he deals with them. And it's up to you to decide whether or not he turns into one. I will say, like, 10 years from now, we'll probably all look back with a good solid answer, but I don't have one now as somebody that is, like, in it still, like, watching, like, the final moments of it, like, for myself. Like, the morality play aspect to Mike Judge's work is still there, and, like, it is still really interesting to see how he tackles the way in which he feels like his earliest work, Beavis and Butthead, got completely misread in his later work.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to something you said there about King of the Hill. Sometimes people fail and sometimes they succeed. The most important thing about King of the Hill and those failures is, even if they fail in trying to do the right thing, in trying to, like, approach the world as a better person, they learn a lesson. And it's not the mm-hmm. type of 90s we learned a lesson where I learned something today. It's more internalized. It's more, oh, I realized that, like, I wanted to be better, and I thought this was how I do it, but then in doing that, I've learned that to actually be better, it requires this, this, and this. And I'm going to attempt to live my life knowing that and to be a better person. And I think that's one of the reasons why King of the Hill is such a great show and why it's held so fondly in the minds of so many people is, unlike, say, a Family Guy, where Peter learns a lesson at the end of the episode, by the next episode, Peter's back to the person he was before he learned that lesson. They press the reset button at the end of every episode of Family Guy. But King of the Hill, it doesn't really press a reset button. To the fact that, like, we saw characters age over the course of the first few seasons. And that's important to, like, understanding that there is growth going on in Arlen, Texas.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the other type of timeline, but there for we eventually get in the 2000s and later, and it was probably something present before, but I don't think we put a name to it till later. The idea of a floating timeline versus a persistent static timeline, yeah. Is that what it is? But like the idea of you have those shows like Family Guy where week to week everything resets, nobody's ever learned anything, versus King of the Hill, or you know it gets put on wider display later when we start to see shows like Adventure Time and all that sort of shit where like the world changes one day and like that change is then dealt with for the rest of the series, like that sort of thing. And Mike Judge really kind of pioneers that aspect specifically in the animated television sitcom, right? Because like Simpsons notoriously does that to the point where they call themselves on it. They call themselves out on it all the time. The idea that Homer loses his job 1,000 times in the first few seasons, but he still always is back at the power plant when they need him to be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the fact that they just did an episode this year where it was the early 2000s, after seeing an episode set, it was the 80s and the 90s episode of The Simpsons that people, you know, universally despise because it turns Homer into Kurt Cobain. in terms of that, and because that 90s episode happens before, you need to understand that The Simpsons, as a commentary on our world, is constantly using these same characters and moving them along with us to be able to comment on what's going on around them. And I don't know, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing. But King of the Hill, existing in this world where actions have consequences, and those consequences might come back the next episode or three seasons later, it was different, and it allowed us to elevate animated entertainment in a very important way.
Yeah.
And I really hope that some of the stuff that we saw get built in Beavis and Butthead Do America does get moved forward into Beavis and Butthead Do America 2, or whatever it ends up being called. The fact that they're honorary ATF agents at the end of this movie, I would love for that to come back in some way.
I would, but part of it, I think, is that, like...
Well, they
like
have to be 14 to 17, but...
Right. But he's so distinctly, or not, right? Depending on what this movie is.
Yeah.
But he so distinctly wants to differentiate between what he was attempting with Beavis and Butthead. And so if you told me with Beavis and Butthead that, like, time didn't shift, like, they exist in a bubble, like, I'd believe that. Whereas I would never that with King of the Hill, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, I kind of am okay with the idea that Beavis and Butthead kind of do because of the work that he was putting in and what he was attempting to do in 1990 versus 10 years later in the year 2000, right? Like, so there's a lot more that I'm willing to understand and forgive about Beavis and Butthead because of the fact that, like, it's early in his career, choices were made, like, he stuck to those choices, like, it wasn't until he moved to other shows that he decided to do his different things. I don't know, I mean, it's wild. I think part of this, though, for me, is I have to point out, as I said in the beginning of this show, I didn't ever, like, I have no reverence for Beavis and Butthead. I have a respect for what it did in the culture, but I have no reverence for it. So if he wants to change up everything, if they end up being 40 years old and just fucking washouts, still watching music videos, that'll still be funny to me, right? Like, I'm not gonna feel like it's a slight against the world of Beavis and Butthead if that's what he decides to do with the next project with them, if it ever comes to fruition.
Right. I mean, you're not wrong about that, especially when you consider the eighth season in the reboot of Beavis and Butthead, and the fact that they were just the same characters, but they got to make comments about music that was 15 years older.
Yeah. Like, well, and I think about how around the same time we also saw the bring back of the super problematic, and for so many reasons, Ren and Stimpy. Remember when there was like a revamp of that too, right? And they did like new Ren and Stimpy episodes, and the ways in which that was received versus Beavis and Butthead. Neither succeeded in any like revolutionizing of the characters, and we didn't like suddenly see a resurgence of Beavis and Butthead everywhere, right? But there was this idea that those that loved it back then still like were like, hey, this is back for a while, love that. And, like, we joked about Celebrity Deathmatch not working either, right? But, like, Ren and Stimpy hit like a fucking, like, it sunk like an anvil when it came back. And it's because we started to learn all of this stuff about the creator of that show, and we started to really kind of reflect on, like, what Ren and Stimpy was doing. And what's really interesting to me about that is Ren and Stimpy is one side of the coin to Beavis and Butthead, in that they go to Nickelodeon, whereas Beavis and Butthead stick to MTV. But Nickelodeon, for anybody that doesn't know, is a product of MTV. So, like, the choice that they are going to move the animation stuff to their quote-unquote kids network, I think for Ren and Stimpy in particular, really ends up being the thing that hurts it. And if I had to maybe reflect on a thing I was not allowed to watch when I was younger, I would say Ren and Stimpy was closer to that line than Beavis and Butthead. And I think it's because Beavis and Butthead was on MTV. It was on the adult network. I was not expected to be watching that anyway. I was, but I wasn't expected to be. Whereas Nickelodeon was a television network that my parents put on during the day when they were trying to keep me busy while they were doing stuff in the house. So, like, if Ren and Stimpy came on, they had to run over and turn it off, right?
I mean, that's,
so, like,
yeah,
it's,
I mean,
it's wild. Yeah,
I think about that too. And, like, you're forbidden from seeing Beavis and Butthead, but, like, Ren and Stimpy was not only a show that I was allowed to watch, but also kind of encouraged to watch, in terms of, like, I was given Ren and Stimpy birthday cards. And I think if you really want to talk about, like, the Shrekification of it all, is that Ren and Stimpy was a cartoon that my mother could also enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, there was a hyper silliness to Ren and Stimpy that was not there in any of Judge's work. Like, right. Judge doesn't go full cartoon. We literally, there's an episode of Beavis and Butthead where we watch them die because things have, like, there's, like, a Halloween episode that when I was a kid, I was always told it was the finale of the series, but in retrospect could not possibly be the truth. But, like, the idea that, like, they get killed at some point, and, like, we see the consequences to the max in that episode.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that, and there's one of those moments too where, The 400 car pileup that happens in this movie one of those situations that, like, every time I've watched this film, and it was my first time 2015, I've watched it a couple of times since, I always wonder, how did they survive that? And, like, that's the wrong question to ask in that moment. Is it doesn't matter how Beavis and Butthead survived jumping out of a 60-mile-per-hour car and then just wanton destruction happening all around them.
Because they're not real people.
Right. And that is the central focus. And it's also interesting when you consider that, like, we talk about Dumb and Dumber, are Harry and Lloyd real people, or are they just, you know, avatars of stupidity and chaos in the world? And, like, this comes out 2 years after Dumb and Dumber, but, like, there's some shades of the road story in Dumb and Dumber and the lack of consequences for those two characters in Beavis and Butthead. But Beavis and Butthead having existed before Dumb and Dumber comes along, you can see how the one influences the other to go on to influence the original.
Well, right, yeah. So, like, as I was saying earlier, like, there's a little piece of this movie where you really truly see Judge's love of film and television, right? And one of those aspects is you point to Dumb and Dumber, which is a great example of a thing that he clearly would have seen before making this movie. Mm-hmm. But the other one that comes to mind with the road trip aspect and everything else that's going on is Blues Brothers, right? Mm-hmm. And to that point, the thing that we have not given enough credit to yet in this episode is the music in this movie. The ways in which music is ever-present, beautiful, and important. Like, the music that they hear in certain moments is actually, like, amazingly well-suited to the moment. And, like, yes, the biggest thing I can think of is Red Hot Chili Peppers singing Roller Coaster of Love as they first enter Vegas. That is, like, that is movie history to me, right?
My Spotify has put that song in my Discover Weekly no less than 12 times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And specifically from Beavis and Butthead to America. And I'm like, I get it. This is Love Roller Coaster as performed in Beavis and Butthead with, like, the cool talky parts and like all of the energy of the original song. It's amazing, but, like, I'm not gonna like it, guys. I'm excited when you play it for me, but I can't be like, I want more songs like this. because there are no more songs like it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But liked and downloaded for me, no, for sure.
I don't
doubt
it.
The way the zombie part later, where they call out that it feels like it's a music video, and then it literally turns into a music video with Ed Roth like style animation with all of the shit.
Love Rat Fink. It's so 90s. It's such a 90s aesthetic in that moment, being married into this.
But there's also the one other thing in the soundtrack that I really think is like a really cool thing to point out, that is, it's in the trivia on fucking IMDb if you want to read more about it. But the version that they use very specifically of the Ozzy song there is not a studio version. It is like a B-side version. And then so much to the point where they can't get the rights to put it on the original soundtrack, so they opt for the original version of Miracle Man there. I can't think of the full name of the song. But
Walk
it
of
is,
something or yeah, something yeah, yeah. Walk. Yeah.
But it's Black Sabbath on the soundtrack. They're forced to use the studio-owned version of that because that's all they have rights to put out and sell in the soundtrack. But in the movie, they go out of their way to use a different version of that song, because that's just like Judge fucking just loves music, which, I mean, if that wasn't evident from the fact that the entire point of Beavis and Butthead, the TV show, is to highlight three music videos an episode and just have them comment on it.
Yeah. I mean, I had a whole TED Talk joke prepared about the music in this, and then we weirdly took it to a more reverential place for this film, where I'm like, yeah, a slant TED Talk joke doesn't feel like it would fit. But the music in this is crazy. I mean, to the fact that, like, Lesbian Seagull, performed by Engelbert Humperdinck in the credits. Like, that was a song that was sung at Yagu by other members of my Boy Scout troop. Like,
well, and then there's that really amazing version of Lesbian Seagull at the end that is sung by who is it that does the like really amazing like funk R&B version of it over the credits?
Oh, I'm pretty sure it's Engelbert Humperdinck, and it's just the music that they dump into it, like. Yeah. Because it is. I look it up every time, and I'm like, it can't really be him, but it has to be, just based on the way that it's credited. But the version that happens in the movie with Van Dryzen, and like how it's broken up by the ATF agents, which, like, that's the next thing we need to talk about. We need to talk about the fact that Robert Stack
is amazing.
Unsolved mystery man with a cavity search fucking kink that he cannot kick. And then my favorite thing is that Robert Stack, like, I don't like that I was in this movie.
Yeah, with all of the fucking work he must have put in to then be like, I don't want to be associated with it. Like, apparently, again, according to IMDb trivia, he was much happier later in life with his association with this film. But, like, by all accounts, when it first came out, he was just like, I am doing serious work here, and this movie has fucked it. And I was like, well, why did you record the lines then, dude?
Why did you give 110% in your performance?
110% every step of the way.
Like, this is a guy, right? Man. So 10 years earlier, Robert Stack is the voice of Ultra Magnus in Transformers the Movie, right? Yeah. Historically, one of the like most reviled films by the people who are making it. Orson Welles on record is saying, I play a big toy that wants to kill a bunch of little toys. And then
that's his exact quote.
Is like, and then like, and they were trying to, you know, introduce the whole Gen 2 of it. So they got all of these big name actors for the movie specifically, knowing that they're not going to be the voices you hear every week when you watch the third season of Transformers. And Robert Stack is Ultra Magnus in it. And his performance in that movie, it sucks. And that is with all respect to Robert Stack for everything that he does. But, like, he clearly, his heart is not in that Transformers movie. Like, very few people who are in that film have their heart in that film. So then you come to this movie, and Robert Stack, as the ATF agent, he is slaying. He is chewing up the scenery like he's Val Kilmer.
Well, and I have to imagine, and here's why I think it's bullshit that he didn't want to be associated with this movie. With the same ways in which we talked about Bruce Willis and David Letterman earlier, where they were clearly given the ability to not be associated with it if they didn't want to, he didn't take that route. He full on is named in the credits.
He is,
and
Yeah.
Like, so if he truly didn't want to be associated with this film, I feel like he would have been given that ability if he really wanted it to, and he didn't choose it. So I think he probably very much enjoyed his time with this film. He probably just was not the thing he wanted to be known for, and for a hot second, it might have looked like it might be the thing he was going to get known for. Rest easy, Mr. Stack. It is not, but like the fact that you're in this film is amazing.
Yeah, I think what it boils down to is that for like a couple of years, probably 5 years after this film comes out, when people see him, they're not doing unsolved mystery quotes. They're saying, get this man a cavity search. And he's annoyed by that. Like how Matt Stone and Trey Parker, to reference our last full episode of the show that we recorded before this time capsule, got sick and tired of being known as the basketball guys. When like, no, we do our own thing.
Yeah. We literally showed up on set drunk off our ass for most of that movie. So, like, we...
Yeah. So for Robert Stack to be like, I thought I was doing important work and I thought I was this, and I thought that, like, it really, even going forward, 6 years into the lifespan of Beavis and Butthead as characters and as cultural touchstones, shows how the message is missed. Because for Robert Stack, he's like, I'm bringing the authority that I present with all of the other things that I do, and everybody is just seeing it as a joke. But really, I'm just supposed to make people realize that I am an authority figure.
Yeah. Oh, man. This movie. Oh,
Greg Kinnear. I just have to say Greg Kinnear as Bork. It's
Greg Kinnear, Cloris Leachman. Leachman. Is phenomenal. And the thing that I, like, fucking freaked out on you about, fucking, like, Guggenheim fellow Eric Bogosian is in this movie, and in, like, multiple roles.
Yeah. We're, like, I mean, it has to be, like, people have to respect Beavis and Butthead for the art of it all, so, like, you get the chance to be a part of it, I mean, you're gonna jump at it. I mean, Cloris Leachman, she was always up for anything and everything. Right? Like, R.I.P. Cloris Leachman, you're missed by the Say Report. And her role in this, that, like, the bonding she does with Beavis, the fact that on some levels, she's just as deranged as the two of them. Having a, like, jumbo-sized bottle of no-drowse pills in her purse because I want to be able to gamble all night in Las Vegas.
And then she has to take the bus home because she lost all of her money.
They're there for less than 24 hours. She bankrupts herself and then is like forced to take a bus home in the same time that they're there for 24 hours at the maximum. Like, and also the fact that she's like, they're good mannered boys. Like, it's one of those things that, like, for how stupid Beavis and Butthead present, and for how reviled they are by members of authority, they're not necessarily disrespectful. They're just stupid.
So they're like, it's weird because I think that really what I would more lean towards is the idea that there was a shift where outward disrespect did not equate to an inward disrespect any longer with teenagers in the 90s. I can't speak to earlier than that. I wasn't alive earlier than that. But that idea so for instance, Beavis and Butthead are in the Hoover Dam, and they're just like they're making fun of, like, is it a goddamn? Or they go to the the geyser there. What is it? Old Faithful. And they're just like, doesn't seem like a lot of water to me. Like,
dude, perfect denouement. Them, like, not being impressed by Old Faithful, but losing their shit over automatic toilets.
Exactly.
It's such good denouement. And I get to say denouement on the show three times, which means that I've summoned denouement. Forever. I am denouement. This is the natural progression of the joke.
Oh, man, he's been a natural progressionist to death. But there's this idea that, like, that disrespect that is on display, because they are clearly disrespectful in those moments, doesn't ever, like, equate to, like, a disrespect of, like, other people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's never aimed at anybody in any hurtful way. So, like, the it's like it's the idea that like the kid that is quiet and keeps to themselves and rolls their eyes at bad jokes and stuff like that, every parent out there wants to talk about how there's something wrong with them, but then we always learn in these movies like that's not the case. Like they're just, that's just who they are, right? Like it's that element, right, just on display much earlier. They're disrespectful in a larger sense, but never disrespectful to specific people, right? And it's a wildly subtle take on like teenagers and like and all of this shit that could only be handled by somebody like Mike Judge and is never like considered by any other maker at this time, filmmaker at this time.
Yeah, I mean the fact that like they meet Cloris Leachman, and I just call her Cloris Leachman because woman on the plane and bus is the clunkiest character title. And when they meet her, and he's like, this chick's cool, baby. Like they're right on board with her. And the way that she talks, and then when Beavis eventually has his like whole speech on the bus, and he's like, this guy's probably scored millions of times. And he's like, oh, you know I have. That guy has scored millions of times, right? That guy has lived a goddamn life. And Cloris Leachman,
he was off in a foreign country. You know something happened.
Like it. It works. It just works on so many different levels, and it's excellent. It truly is excellent, and I'm glad that I've given this movie a second watch, because on 30 hours of driving over the course of a weekend and like, well, this isn't going to work out, and I didn't get to see my friend, putting on this movie, I kind of had a natural predilection to not enjoy it. But now it is one of those films that I do. I mean, it's not something I could watch all the time, right? But it's definitely something that's like worth putting on every so often and just getting to dive into their world.
I don't think I could watch this movie all the time, for sure. I'm right there with you. It's not even one that I think I'm going to like sit down with the family and watch. But what I could do after this is I could continue to watch more Mike Judge stuff.
Yeah.
Like the next thing I go and watch is probably going to be King of the Hill. It's probably going to be Idiocracy. It's going to be off. You know what I mean? Like I may not go back to this particular thing of his, but it has made me really want to go back to a lot of his stuff in general. Right. And I'm lucky enough that he has been prolific enough that I can do that for a long while, that by the time I'm done doing it, I can start again, go back to Beavis and Butthead Do America.
Yeah. I mean, you get to celebrate his entire collection.
Right.
I'm sorry. So we have to touch on one other thing. It's something that I mentioned to you before you struck down to the Eric Bogosian of it all, which, again, thank you so much for that. Is that the plot of this film that was released 25 years ago is a stolen biological warfare agent, a virus that could wipe out 5 states in 5 days. And that hit different in 2021.
With a plane crash in it, right?
I mean, the plane doesn't crash. They do land safely.
They don't crash yet.
But it is a reminder.
They break into the captain's cabin, which is what causes it, right? And all that sort of shit.
Yeah,
there's a lot going on. That entire plane scene would play out entirely different, and I'll tell you why. The main reason being there would be an agent on board, right? And we'd have to deal with that particular character that we didn't ever see in this movie. But yeah, man, the biological agent storyline, but at the same time, super on brand for that 90s just bullshit story, right? A biological agent stolen from a government facility that they may or may not let off in a major city with delegates from other countries is like such beautiful stock standard like Hollywood nonsense that, again, this goes back to Judge and his love of cinema and stuff like that. It's not just old cinema, it's also current cinema. Like there's just such a joy in my heart that is like the kind of story that Beavis and Butthead find themselves in, because it fits beautifully with their 1990s aesthetic.
Yeah, I think where it all kind of boiled into for me, right, is that by 1996, we were so cynical about like bomb threats and things that there is that joke when they're like, we need to evacuate the White House, where the Secret Service agent says, I gotta find it, probably just another bomb threat or something.
Yeah.
Like
and then it just wanders away. It doesn't even like run to anybody.
Yeah, and it's and there's no urgency to get people out of the building, as we see that like Tom and his wife are still walking around, and
minutes
and like
later, yeah.
Yeah, it's just so interesting in terms of like, I mean, we're coming up on, we're recording this in August, I believe it's the 24th, right? Yeah, it's August 24th right now while we're recording this time capsule episode, so we're close to a pretty big 20-year anniversary. In the history of this country.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Oh, you said you'd never forget, CJ.
Like, what is happening on the show?
No. It just like one of those things. But then
has got, you've been doing this for so long.
But to think about the fact that like 5 years before that occurred, we had already become sort of sick of the idea of the threat of terrorism. And, yep. Like, 93, we have the World Trade Center bombing, and then we have the Oklahoma City bombing, and in 1996, the Olympic Park bombing, and all of that, to the fact that, like, we as Americans had just sort of semi-internalized it, and it was more of just a slight annoyance than something that we actually needed to treat with some urgency, is, like, that you can't ignore that particular mirror that Mike Judge is holding up to everything.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And then,
well, and that's why I laughed when earlier we kind of said that he tries to stay non-political, is like, at the end of the day, nobody truly can, right? But I guess it's not that dangerous of a political stance to be like, hey, we're all getting a little too comfortable with the fact that we keep bombing ourselves, huh?
Yeah. Well, he's one of those guys who's like, he's spinning in a circle. He's doing a windmill, his fists are out, and he's hitting everybody. It's not that he's just punching conservatives or punching liberals. He is, anybody is a target for him. And like, that's the way to truly stay neutral, right? And to sort of celebrate neutrality, is where you're willing to call out both sides.
And I want to make sure that I put a foot down here, at least for myself. I won't speak for Devin or the show or anything like that. But like, centrism is a kind of a bullshit concept in this day and age. Like, I come from a belief of that, right? Like, it's not that I believe that, like, oh, he's a true centrist. No, because that's a whole other fucking can of worms. But I do agree with the idea that he is willing to take a look at all sides, and he is willing to call stuff out. It's just that he doesn't apply the same level of immediacy and danger to his comedy that a lot of people that claim to be centrist comedians do. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of centrist comedians will be like, oh, there's equal nut jobs on either side. And we know that that's not true.
That's not true in 2021.
Right. And that's not at all what Judge is ever trying to say. He's not saying that there's an equal issue on both sides of the conversation, whatever that conversation may be. He's just pointing out that there is a side to be considered on each side. And that is a very different concept than like the idea of quote unquote true centrism and all that shit.
Yeah. So it's not that he's a centralist or that he's neutral. He's kind of willing to play devil's advocate a lot of the time with his art.
Right.
I think that's the fairest way to put it, without ascribing anything deeper to the man or his art. But I say neutral in the terms of like, it's not that Beavis and Butthead Do America is not them going door to door beating up Republicans.
right. Or vice versa.
Yeah.
It's also not them going around and him being like, you damn kids don't know what it's like in this world. Like, it's not either of those alone. It's those side by side.
Yeah. It's a little from A, a little from B. And also, I mean, just talking about film and how film works, there's a lot that Jay and Silent Bob Struck Back stole from this film in a way that like I didn't think I had like truly come to terms with the first time I watched it.
Yeah, I mean, like I would argue that there's a lot that Jay and Silent Bob knowingly, like I think mm-hmm. it's expected that the audience is on board with, steals from a lot of this particular style of buddy comedy meets road comedy. So like, yeah, but it's more for me the idea being that like it steals from all of these kinds of movies.
Yeah,
you know,
like, I mean, that's
from
the this, point. From Vacation, I feel like that's the point.
From
but
Due Date of all fucking movies. I'm with you.
But when you look at Jay and Silent Bob, and a lot of the times they're compared to Cheech and Chong, Bill and Ted, Beavis and Butthead, right? Like, I had never really thought about it until I was watching the film today with a more critical eye and being like, oh, look at that. There's a lot of, like, they've become accidental terrorists. Jay and Silent Bob end up doing 5 years later.
Yeah, for like, sure. There's definitely the whole...
like central plot points is more what I'm talking about. Is them becoming the scapegoat for worse individuals.
I don't remember Beavis and Butthead ever going up against Darth Hamill, but Mark Hamill.
I'm fine with Darth Hamill. Bring it on, Mark Hamill. We've called you out. We know you've aligned with the dark side.
I'm sorry, but him as Cockknocker in that movie is always going to be just fucking choice
so
for
good.
Me.
I mean, Carrie Fisher as the nun, which again, Beavis and Butthead winding up on a bus full of nuns. And, I mean, that right there's some commentary I dig. That, like, at first they welcome them in, these two lost souls. But then eventually they are not above abandoning them at the Petrified Forest.
Yeah, there is some good bits for that, too. Shit. Yeah. Like, I mean, man, I offhandedly mentioned the bit with Chelsea Clinton earlier where originally it was written to be super obscure. So if they needed to, if Clinton was on his way out the door, they could have drawn in her packing a bag rather than just like folding laundry, which is like a weird like way to look at that joke. But yeah, like that is I believe that because of how subtle a lot of the other stuff is that we've pointed out, right? So the idea that if Clinton had lost, they would have walked in on Chelsea Clinton packing her suitcase would have actually been quite hilarious. It just the world didn't work that way.
Yeah, it's like
Bob Dole didn't win. Bob Dole just watches Beavis Butthead and cries now.
I notice you have braces. I have braces too. yeah. I think so. Now just one more confession from the Beavis and Butthead thing. On my hand I had to write Butthead brown hair, Beavis blonde hair.
The way that I always remember it, and this has been true the entire, like, my entire life, is that I can so clearly hear Butthead in my head saying, Beavis.
Come on, Beavis.
Right. And so knowing that, that is how I differentiate them. When I need to figure out who is who, I'm like, well, the quote is, come on, Beavis. And so, like, clearly that's Butthead. So then Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah, he's not talking to himself in the third person. We didn't go that obscure with the comedy.
Roger Ebert... openly admits multiple times in his retrospective of his critique of the film that he can't tell them apart and he doesn't think that matters.
Yeah, no, and that's fair. But that's why I'm like, I need to make sure. I mean, I did it at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
That I wrote it there. And it's still on my hand, even though I've washed my hand a bunch of times because, you know, you wash your hands a bunch of times in 2021.
Can I ask you a closing thought on this movie?
Oh, yes, please.
A lot of rumors as I was doing research today about possible live action was like the idea for this film.
I know.
Conceived. And the casting that was put out there was the idea of possibly a David Spade, Chris Farley team up once again. Is there anyone else that you think would have been really good?
Well, one of the rumors that I saw was David Spade was pretty much always going to be the Beavis character.
Right.
But they had talked about it being Adam Sandler if this had gone live action.
As
Butthead. And the final thing is that the only reason this movie is animated is a coin toss.
Yeah.
They flipped a coin. So, like, there is a universe out there where Beavis and Butthead Do America is part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And I really hope that version of us, first of all, are doing an Adam Sandler podcast and also are giving it its reverence.
I will say that I really could not help but think this would have been a phenomenal Pauly Shore vehicle.
Oh, man.
So with that in mind, I then got really sad because I thought this would have been an amazing re-team up of Pauly Shore and Brendan Fraser.
I would have loved it. I would have absolutely loved it.
Like,
I mean,
1996 version of the two of them doing Beavis and Butthead.
Don't do that. Like, it was already hard enough for me to come to terms with the fact that, like, this was almost an Adam Sandler film.
I know.
And then, like, you do that, and it's like, that would have also worked.
It would have been a perfect point in his career where he would not have been known enough for action roles or heavy roles where he couldn't also dip in and do a butthead. But, like, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, George of the Jungle is a year out, and and that kicks off Brendan Fraser doing live-action adaptations. Mm-hmm. So if it's Brendan Fraser and Pauly Shore as Beavis and Butthead, I don't know who is who. As we speculate, this is all speculation. There's nothing that supports this belief, right? This is pure Say Report speculation, right? I just want to confirm that.
No, yeah, this is all dreams coming together here in this one moment. That's
very much like in the film when there's a convergence on the one central location. This is the convergence of all the beliefs of the Say Report coming together for the wrap up of this time capsule episode of Beavis and Butthead to America. Who would be who?
I really think that Pauly Shore needs to be Beavis and
just for Cornholio.
Right? and then you get Brendan Fraser as Butthead with like a lot more of the heavier lines in the movie. It just would be phenomenal. That's all.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, I'd be happy either way. But yeah.
I'd like to see Pauly Shore with the blonde hair. That's what it really boils down to for me, and it probably means that Pauly Shore doesn't end up making Biodome, right?
Which is basically Beavis and Butthead do a Biodome, yeah, for sure, yeah.
I mean, and there's the other, that's the other unfortunate tightrope. I would hate Beavis and Butthead do America if it was Pauly Shore and Stephen Baldwin.
Yeah, you had to think about what Baldwin it was, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I heard
that hesitancy in your voice.
Billy Baldwin has been on my mind today. He dropped off his kids at college today.
Aww.
And he bought a UNC I'm not sure. I think it's UNC. He bought a sweatshirt in the bookstore, and he posted a selfie of himself in his little shirt supporting his kid's school, and then said, "And I'm having to take out a second mortgage on the house to pay for all of this." And it's like, man, Billy Baldwin, you did not read the room. and there's that moment because Bruce Willis as Muddy Grimes is not doing the Bruce Willis voice. He is very much acting, which I appreciate. I honestly do appreciate. And again, that's not throwing any shade on Demi Moore. Demi Moore is not doing the traditional Demi Moore voice. She kind of feels like she's tapping into the character she played in One Crazy Summer with the character of Dallas Grimes.
And she does the work that same year, if you want to talk about amazing voice work that Demi Moore has done, in fucking
Hunchback of Notre Dame,
right? Yeah. So she's putting in the work that year. She's allowed to maybe take a little easy on fucking Beavis and Butthead do America.
Right, exactly. Right. But I just want to make sure that, like, the fact that Bruce Willis, like, clearly is trying not to sound like Bruce Willis does not reflect on anybody else how they come to this film.
Yeah.
Like, that's just a fact.
And then Robert Stack is just pure Robert Stack.
Robert Stack's playing Robert Stack. Dale Reeves, you know, noted Bill Clinton impersonator, making me happy to hear him. But it's just one of those situations where, like, I don't know. There was a moment where I thought that it was Alec Baldwin playing Muddy Grimes.
And that it was
going to end up being Kim Basinger as his wife. Because they were the couple beforehand. Like, it would have worked. It would have totally worked. And you see that picture, and that picture of Dallas kind of evokes more Kim Basinger's thoughts. And it's not until I heard Demi Moore when I'm like, well, then that has to be Bruce Willis, right? Because of the same exact thing I assigned to, oh, that's Alec Baldwin, so Kim Basinger is playing the wife. I just, like, it has to be a couple. That's what Mike Judge does with this piece of art. That's the meta that he is looking for.
Yeah, for sure.
I had to think of the Baldwin. I'm sorry.
No.
You know the last time I watched Biodome? We don't celebrate Pauly Shore History Month.
Also, if there was a Baldwin that I wish we would all forget about, it's Stephen Baldwin, so it's okay.
He ruined the Slapshot franchise. I'm saying it.
Yeah, that's the worst thing he's done.
Oh, he also became like a real big Trump supporter. I know, I saw him on The Apprentice. But yes, no, that would suck. This movie would suck if it was Pauly Shore and Stephen Baldwin. And I still had to do it. and that's just a fact. Like, I don't know if you get Brendan Fraser. It would be awesome. Imagine if he kicks off his live action adaptation stuff with a Beavis and Butthead movie. Oh, I'm going to have great dreams tonight, and I thank you for that, Seijin. My only hope is that with Paramount Plus getting a sequel to this movie, right? It's been greenlit. There's not a lot about it, but there's enough saying that a sequel to this film is finally in the works. I hope Brendan Fraser plays some role in that.
Yeah, right? We can only hope, man.
Yeah, there's that. And also, I think really interesting is that this film was available on Amazon Prime, right? It's probably not available on Amazon Prime when you're listening to this time capsule episode due to the nature of a time capsule episode.
Right, right.
Because it says it's only there for 8 more days. And my guess, right, and I will confirm it in the episode that releases after this episode, if I'm right or not, is that Beavis and Butthead Do America has to be heading to Paramount Plus.
Yeah.
Which is why they're willing to announce that they're working on a sequel as a way to draw in subscribers.
Damn.
Whew, that's a lot. I feel like we covered a lot. Anything else that you think needs to be added before we send this one off to the Say Report vault?
No, I mean, like, I feel like we should walk off into the sunset just like these two dumbasses do.
As honorary members of the Board of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, can we give ourselves that title? I mean, how do honorary titles work?
Cigarette and beer?
Awesome. Cigarette, beer, and also fire. Get fire. Oh, man. Yeah, it's a good one. I think the only thing that I'm going to add is, if you didn't watch the movie before hearing us talk about it, that's completely fine. But you have to go listen to the version of Love Roller Coaster that is featured in this movie. I understand why Spotify is trying to get me to like and download it. Because it's good. It's really good. And it is a perfect example of the music that is on, like, display in this film.
Yep.
And that's it. So, if you would like to further help Seijin with his deciphering of the Rosetta Stone of 90s popular culture, you can get him directly on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
And if you want to help Devin determine which Baldwin is in which movie, you can catch him at Devin D. Tecker.
Which Baldwin are we Baldwin about? All right, Will, that was not funny enough for me to end on. You got to get us out of here. Good night, folks.
Thank you for listening to the Say Report with your host Devin Decker and Seijin Serwick. Please follow the guys on Twitter and Facebook by searching for The Say Report, and you can always subscribe on your podcast channel so this is delivered straight to you and you can enjoy it every week. With apologies to your mother, we'll see you next time.